You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 86. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about respectful engagement with Indigenous communities with the Heritage Lands Collective. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute Peoples, Treaty Lands, the Dene Tah, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. And today, we have Joseph Gazing Wolf back on the show. So excited to have you, Joseph. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm Joseph Gazing Wolf. I'm Lakota from Standing Rock. My mother is also Amazigh and Nubian from Upper Egypt. And I'm currently a PhD student finishing up my PhD at Arizona State University in Environmental Life Science. I'm also the new executive director of the Heritage Lands Collective.
Yes. Okay. So Joseph was on the show, you'll remember, a couple episodes back when we were talking about the Boulder Ethnographic Education Project. And there's been a change since that episode. So you may have noticed that he said the Heritage Lands Collective. So Joseph, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So we've recently changed our name. The Heritage Lands Collective was once known as the Living Heritage Research Council. And of course, you, Jessica, also have an organization called Living Heritage Anthropology. And so it kind of became confusing to function as the two organizations together for many of our partners and for ourselves. So we decided to change the name. And of course, with new leadership, we're taking a little bit of a different focus and expanding our purview a little bit in terms of the communities we work with, but also what we're emphasizing as we move forward. So we thought a change of name would help maintain our sanity on both ends, but also kind of, you know, with new leadership and expanding our purview, we thought the name change would be a good fit.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, for context, I run Living Heritage Anthropology, like Joseph mentioned, which is my for-profit. And then I co-founded Heritage Lands Collective back when it was Living Heritage Research Council. And basically, people just started calling both of them Living Heritage and thinking of them as one organization. And they're really not. They're two very separate organizations, even though I am involved with both of them. So for all the reasons Joseph mentioned and that, it seemed like a time for a new start. And I think Joseph and the rest of the Heritage Lands Collective team did a great job in reframing that name. I'm very excited about it personally. Mm. All right. So Joseph, I'm very excited to have you, obviously, for many reasons, you know, us working together on lots of different things. And also because you are coming to the show from a different background from most of our guests that I think is really important. It's really important for people to see how environmental sciences and cultural resources are not so different. Mm-hmm. So anyway, if you could talk first about, you know, what got you into this work?
Well, I think initially for me, it was just the way I was raised, the way I grew up. I was born in Egypt and with my mother's people, and growing up there, it became quite clear because of the context in which I was born. I was born into severe poverty, and Indigenous peoples there are, the history there is much like the history here in terms of land displacement, etc. And so a lot of tribal communities in Northern Africa have kind of been extremely marginalized. In Egypt in particular, the Nubian people have been displaced by the Aswan Dam. And when that dam was built by Europeans, it flooded our traditional lands along the Nile. And so what ended up happening is we were displaced to the city of Aswan and lost much of our ancestral lands. So anyway, the experience, kind of the daily experience of seeing my culture disappear, my language disappear. And then because I grew up in poverty, I had to leave. I never met my biological parents initially, and I had to leave my grandparents who were raising me at the time, and I had to go work at the age of 5. And so being away from my grandparents and kind of being sucked into a system that was not created by me or for me, right? But that gave me greater privileges, right? So getting to work, I worked for free for Egyptian farmers, but I got room and board, which is better than, you know, living in a giant landfill in garbage city, right? So mm-hmm. So being able to work and get a better life for myself, but seeing how that's costing me my very identity because of historical factors, for me, that was kind of the foundation of it. And then leaving Garbage City and going to Upper Egypt to my actual ancestral homelands and working on somebody's farm who's replaced my people, and seeing how beautiful the Nile is, the Nile riparian areas, as well as the Sahara Desert that's right outside of the riparian areas, and how absolutely mystical and beautiful it is. You know, I never wanted to return back to the city, and I promised myself, I remember sitting under the stars with my donkey and looking up at the stars and kind of promising myself that not only will I never leave this place, but also that everything that created this place, right, in terms of indigenous heritage and culture, everything that created the absolute mystery and beauty of Upper Egypt, as well as the Amazigh people and the oases, right, that I never actually got to visit. But these beautiful places of heritage, that I would live the rest of my life protecting these places and protecting the cultures and revitalizing the cultures and restoring the cultures that have produced these beautiful places. Because in my mind, there was never a separation between people and land. And so if you walk upon a land that you consider beautiful or majestic, right, or that inspires awe in you, that's a direct result of the people that have stewarded that land for thousands of years, right? So that's kind of where it began for me. And then it just got, as my life, personal life developed, and I came to the U.S., I ended up losing my grandfather right away after I moved here, my Amazigh grandfather. And his loss shocked me even more in terms of like, oh my gosh, like there's so much I had still wanted to learn from him, and he was gone. And then later, you know, I'm living here with my Lakota father and his family, and seeing and re-experiencing the same history here. And so I realize, oh, well, I still have my grandmother alive in Egypt, and I would love to go back and visit her. And I cut the ticket, right? I finally like worked my butt off and saved some money to be able to afford a really expensive flight to Egypt. And she was looking forward to seeing me and us reconnecting again. And sure enough, like a month and a half before I was going to go, she ends up passing away suddenly.
No.
And she was just, she's an Amazigh woman, half Amazigh and half Nubian. And she had, this woman grew up without any formal education whatsoever. And yet she lived her entire life, for example, without refrigeration. She knew she knew how to preserve meat, fish, cheese. I mean, she would make wonders in a kitchen that most Western folks would not even recognize as a kitchen, right? Because it's a stone, you know, piece of stone masonry kind of thing that she would put sticks in and cook and make amazing things in that. And she knew how to preserve everything without refrigeration, because that's what our people learned for tens of thousands of years. I mean, preservation for Amazigh and Nubian people is dumbfounding. There have been seeds recovered in Egypt, for example, that are 30,000 years old and still viable.
Wow, that's insane.
So not only were our people masters of agriculture, but masters of preservation. And of course, it's thanks to the ecology, right? Because the Sahara Desert will preserve anything, right? Mummification wasn't an Egyptian, like people associate that with Egyptians. It's really the Saharan Desert that taught us, you know, what mummification is really. So anyway, yeah. And part of the reason why Egypt is such a rich place of history is because of the preservation of so much about our history and the history of humanity. I mean, if you, like you, Jessica, you're a Jewish person, and mm-hmm. many Christian folks, you know, value the Bible as something that's very important, right? And the Tanakh and the Torah are central to your identity. And for Christians, of course, the Greek Bible is as well. And the oldest manuscripts, almost all the oldest manuscripts we have of the Bible, were discovered in Egypt because they're preserved by that wonderful arid environment for, you know, millennia. And so the most accurate manuscripts we have of many of our spiritual, you know, important spiritual texts come from Egypt as well for that same reason. So you have the Codex Sinaiticus, the Codex Alexandrinus, things people can Google and look up. But these are it's a history that is incredibly rich and has influenced much of global history, but is virtually unknown. And that to me is what inspired me to try and protect that culture and that history and that knowledge.
Okay. Wow. So first of all, I can't tell you how happy that made me when you said the Tanakh. I'm like, oh my God, I don't think I've ever had a non-Jew repeat or, you know, like know a word yeah. that in depth before. That just made me so happy because usually it's like, I don't know, like happy Hanukkah. And it's like, okay, that's like not even an important holiday at all. It's just right, the one right. that you all know. So to like have somebody throw a word like that at me, it's like, whoa. It just made me so happy. But okay. Yeah. So going from there, that is what like got you interested in this type of work. But how did you like go from that point to like where you are today?
Yeah, so I think the loss of elders early on in life and not knowing my parents early on in life was kind of the driving force. And so it encouraged me to spend as much time with local elders, knowledge holders, you know, people that can teach me not just about my own history and identity as well as language, you know, but also people that can teach me skill sets that have been either lost or replaced, right? And so the driving force for me was like, okay, I'm losing all these elders, and with every elder that passes away, you know, an entire library of knowledge passes with them, and this cannot be acceptable. This is not sustainable for our communities, and it's really not sustainable for the planet when we lose this knowledge and these ways of life. I mean, I honestly, you know, people might call me a little too dramatic as an ecologist when I say this, but you know, if we lose tribal knowledge and indigenous heritage across these lands, I see no hope for humanity in terms of addressing climate change mm-hmm. and the incredible drastic negative reverberations it's going to have on human communities across the world. Mm-hmm. So the losing elders early on, I think, is what kind of shocked me into realizing like they're incredibly precious. And so I'm going to take every opportunity I can, given the very difficult life I was given, take every opportunity I can to spend time with them. And so I engrossed myself in land management, you know, every job I can get. You know, I begged the farmers that I worked for to let me stay there for, you know, work for them for free as long as I stay there on the land and keep working. And then when I came here to the States, you know, I got into agriculture and ranching and buffalo ranching right away, because that's where I was able to connect with these elders, these land stewards, right, that hold this knowledge. And so part of the reason I chose that path is not just to protect these beautiful landscapes that are important for our life, but also to reconnect with the knowledge holders who have stewarded these lands.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit more about your experience with working with your elders in Buffalo? And
yeah, so like more specifics about how I got into all of that. So, mm-hmm. so the community where I lived, you know, I grew up in Bullhead, South Dakota, and that's kind of like, I grew up actually on Tatanka Road, which is funny. Uh-huh. So Tatanka is a Lakota word for buffalo. And so part of the reason it's called that is because the tribal buffalo herd kind of originated there and has since changed over time, but it was essentially run out of that area. And so my family, my relatives have been involved in buffalo stewardship for quite some time. And so my ancestors, my grandfather was involved in the reintroduction of a herd at Standing Rock and other places. And so that kind of situated me well to be able to develop an early relationship and, you know, again, like realizing that my grandparents, my Lakota grandparents, grew up without ever encountering buffalo until they decided to reintroduce a herd and the opportunity came up for them to do so. Like they themselves never encountered buffalo because they were, you know, as you know, they were, you know, taken away to boarding schools and they had their language ripped from them, et cetera, et cetera. So like that fact that they were reconnecting with buffalo themselves at the same time that I was connecting with buffalo is just dumb. I mean, it still boggles my mind, but anyway, and my grandfather was, he was a poet and a very romantic person. And so he would write poetry about buffalo and would teach me in his own kind of loving poetic way about buffalo. And so like, because I was very close to my grandfather here, as I was in Egypt as well, the connection I had with the person connected me with the land. And so you might notice that when we're like out in the field, I'm not a very good ethnographer because I go off script quite a bit and I get lost in conversation with these elders, because to me, it's like being in the presence of my grandfather and grandmother once again. And so like I go off script quite a bit and like start talking about other things that I shouldn't probably be asking them. But it's via my family here that I was able to connect with buffalo. And then, you know, once you're in the presence of buffalo and you're touched by them, it's really difficult to let go, right? It's really difficult to not want that experience on a daily basis, because, you know, I bring out a lot of my non Lakota, non Indigenous friends, and they love to spend time with buffalo, and I give them some guidelines as to how to do it, right? That, you know, be present, like try not to talk too much, try to be present with this relative, this important relative. And when they do that, you know, the most common feedback I get is, when a buffalo looks at me, I feel like it's piercing my soul. And that's exactly right. I mean, that's exactly the first feeling I got when I had one-on-one time with a herd of buffalo. And so there is a very special relationship between, you know, all the Ocheti Shakawin people, but that special relationship, it's a relationship. And so it's inspired as much by the nature of our buffalo relatives as it is by our response to them. And so I started working with the tribal herd and then expanded from there, moved to, when I moved to Ofres after my parents passed, some of my cousins and other relatives continued to work in Standing Rock. I went and consulted with the Oglala Lakota for a while, and then went and worked in Montana and Wyoming at several buffalo ranches there. And then from there, you know, decided to sell my soul to the devil and become an academic. But yeah, that's kind of the story of how I got into that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, on that note, first I will say that Joseph, you are an excellent ethnographer. So no saying that. And second, we are at our first break point. So we are going to take a break here and then we will be right back. Okay. So we are back from our break and you left off there talking about how you sold your soul to the sun devils of academia. And so, yeah, I'd love to hear more about like what your experience was like, or is like, I guess, has been like, going through that journey of academia and what you've ended up focusing your work on.
Yeah. So what's fascinating. So I left off talking about my experience in Buffalo. And so, you know, to me, the natural thing was, if I was going to become or pursue education anyways, that I was going to research and become a researcher in you know, large animal grazing and buffalo as a particular focus. And that's how I started off, was as a strict ecologist, right? And, you know, I looking back, I was so adorable when I was.
You're still adorable, Joseph.
Yeah, I was adorably naive because, you know, I thought joining the academy meant I was going to be joining a community of learned scholars who are highly intelligent and capable of critical thinking.
I mean, you were going to ASU. Yeah. Sorry, the Arizona Wildcat and me had to throw that out there.
You U of A people. very early experiences. I mean, from the first week I started my PhD program, I actually started at a different program than ASU. And, you know, I mean, after leaving the res, I worked primarily with white ranchers, right? White rural folk. And yeah, you know, there was just typical generic ignorance, but I'd never experienced any form of like explicit racism or alienation or degradation of my skill sets and intelligence and things like that.
Wow.
Yeah, I never experienced anything like that. In fact, quite the opposite. Many of my white brothers and sisters that I worked with, you know, I remember times where, yeah, we'd be out working and, you know, dudes would drive by in their truck and yell out, I don't know if I can use expletives on your show, but
they sure? would be, you know, you also don't have to, though.
You know, they would yell out, you know, rednecks and things like that. That's a quite common experience, especially when you're working buffalo, because, you know, they don't want that dirty animal back on their land, or what they perceive as their land, right? So So there's a lot of, when you're a buffalo rancher, you know, you get to experience a lot of very interesting things. But when I would experience those things, including when I would go out with the cowboys that worked with me, and many of them would stand up. I mean, many of them would be more offended than I was by these experiences, right? And they'd get very angry and protective of me. And so if anything, the people I worked with were good family, what people I considered family. And then I came to the academy, and here are people that have zero life experience whatsoever. They've only ever been in school their whole life.
Right.
Most of them come from white suburbia, have little to no understanding of virtually anything in the world. And I say that with all due respect. It's just reality, right? When you grow up in white suburban America, what experience of the real world do you really have, right? Mm-hmm. Everything is convenient. You've never had to work a hard day in your life, especially if you're a white kid who's in your like early 20s, right? It's a life that's nice. It's very nice. It's very cushy, but it's extremely limited in its purview of what the hell is happening in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And yet people think like they're saving the earth, and they're the magnificence of all things. The high rates of arrogance and narcissism in the academy is untenable. And I've never experienced anywhere near the amount of grotesque racism in rural white America as I have in the liberal white academy, right? Mm. So anyway, it got so grotesque at the first program that I ended up transferring to ASU to complete my PhD. And the biggest complaint that the people I work with, the mentors who are wonderful, most of whom are white and are wonderful human beings, the biggest complaint they had was, hey, you're not coming to campus enough. And I was like, yes, exactly. there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
So the way I've been able to survive at ASU is working with wonderful scholars, but doing it at a distance from the campus itself. And And that's really unfortunate, but that's kind of the way it has to be, because I have high tolerance for racists. I can actually work with racist people. Because I see that more as a curable disease. Mm-hmm. It's a disease of ignorance, and so it could be curable. Narcissism, on the other hand, arrogance, on the other hand, that is just simply not a curable disease. It's a much, much, much more difficult disease to cure than racism is. And so to me, I can work with people that are considered horribly grotesque by liberal white folks. I cannot work, for the most part, with liberal white folks who have such high levels of narcissism. And the reason I recognize narcissism in that community is because I had worked in contexts of like domestic, a lot of my community work has been focused on domestic violence and sexual abuse of children and women and all of that. And so you see the impact that narcissism has on real people's lives, right? Many of the perpetrators of these horrifying crimes are really high narcissists. So, whereas Western culture has just completely glamorized narcissism to be, this like cutesy personality quirk, it's not. It's a horrifying disease, and it should be addressed as such. And it's related to all sorts of vicious violence. And so I have zero tolerance for narcissism, which is why I stay away from academic campuses in general. And that's been my experience in the academy. And because of that, I realized, well, a lot of the reason that I'm experiencing this is because these white kids from white suburbia and their white older kids of PIs that they work with, right? Because they all come from the same place. The principal investigator is exactly the same as his or her student. And so these folks have just not had any encounter, any experience of Native communities, Native cultures, Native knowledge, right? And so I realized, okay, well, what I need to do is gather my people around me. And so I started doing that via the traditional ecological knowledge section of the Ecological Society of America. So I used a more diverse community of scholars who were more likely to respond to claims of diversity and inclusion. And so I applied to a grant via the National Science Foundation and brought together 21 Native ecologists and environmental scientists from across North America, and began my own community of Natives that are working on in similar ways with similar knowledges, right? And so that's the only reason I've remained in the academy at all, is because I created the academy. I created my own experience essentially in the academy. And so my dissertation focus now, instead of being buffalo, which is what I wanted to study initially, is now, how do we maintain indigenous persistence in STEM, right? How do you fit an indigenous way of knowing and the people that carry that indigenous way of knowing into a settler colonial system that was designed precisely to erase them, right? This is the question now. With all this diversity and inclusion stuff and interest in indigenous knowledge, a lot of universities are working really hard to like recruit Native people and Native students. Like, that's great. But to ask somebody to come into a settler colonial context and say, now, it's nice that you're Native, but you need to act white, talk white, dress white, poop white, burp white, right? Like you have to be white in every way, like rid yourself of your identity completely, right? That's nothing other than extreme racism and exploitation, right? You're just, supercharging settler colonialism with a pretentious diversity and inclusion agenda. And so what I do now, my research now, is to say, well, here's how your institution needs to change from the perspective of Native scholars. Here's how your institution needs to change in order for you to actually have any kind of genuine relationship with Native people. Otherwise, all you are is a system of erasure. And so the only way to deal with a system of erasure is to destroy it, to dismantle it completely. So anyone who wants to actually engage with Native communities at their institution, you have to begin by dismantling the settler colonial institution itself and its many mechanisms of exclusion and erasure of Native people.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask the big, hard question, which is, what did you find? Like, what recommendations would you give?
Well, I mean, there are many. What I ended up discovering is that it's essentially that my experience wasn't abnormal. Mm. I mean, the first, I held a workshop in Montreal, Canada in 2022, right before the Ecological Society of America's conference. And, you know, I spent two entire days just listening to the majority of them were Native women and my sisters sitting there talking about how, you know, they experienced all sorts of dehumanization in their lab groups. They were sexually assaulted by their PIs. They were dehumanized to the point where they ended up leaving their PhD programs altogether or transferring to another program, right? Or leaving the academy even after they got their PhD, ended up leaving the academy and going somewhere else, right? And so I spent two full days of like hearing this. And I grew up being a traditional Native man and being very protective of my sisters. And so at the same time, what's funny is, you know, we held it right before ESA's conference so that we can report out from the workshop, right? So 2 days, the weekend right before a full week of ESA conference. And then I applied to give a workshop where I had the entire panel of the 21 Native scholars sitting up front, and each of them got up to speak briefly. Anyway, in order for you to do that, you submit a proposal to ESA, it gets reviewed, the reviews come back, and then your presentation is accepted or denied. Anyway, at that conference, right while I was holding the workshop, one of the reviews came back saying something to the effect of, I was really worried that you were saying we should listen to these Aboriginal peoples. But now I understand that you're talking about ecologists and indigenous ecologists. So I'm not as worried anymore, right? And by the way, he gave us bad reviews, which means in the ESA system that goes back to the ESA administration, somebody has to look at it, approve it, and send it back to me as the presenter. In other words, ooh, ESA saw this, said it was okay to send it to a Native scholar.
Oh my God.
And yeah. So anyway, so 2 days of hearing like abuse of my sisters and then this review. And then I had that on the Monday, I had requested to meet with the administration of ESA to discuss like, how the hell is your system so incompetent that this is possible, right? Yeah. That's basically what I want to discuss with them. And the leader of ESA, the director or whatever the name of the office is, didn't end up showing up. It ended up being the same people, the same diversity and inclusion folks that always have worked with me from ESA. They're the ones who ended up showing up. The leaders did not. And so I was really irate at this point because it's like, wow, dude, wow. In a single shot, I've brought you 21 Indigenous scholars, which is unprecedented in your entire history, ESA. And this is how you, like, this is how you respond to this, right? While giving me a bunch of BS about wanting to work with Native people, et cetera, right? Mm. So anyway, during the workshop, you know, I had the panel of my people there, and I wasn't going to speak at all. I was already exhausted, 2 days of not sleeping, right? But my sisters, two of my sisters who were there, turned to me and they're like, hey, you have to get up and talk about this racist review. It's important for these people to hear that. Yeah. So I was like, dang it.
I'm tired.
I was exhausted and wasn't planning on speaking, so I had nothing to prepare. And anyway, I always do what my sisters tell me to do because, you know, my mama didn't raise no fools. So I got
generally a good policy,
right? Yeah. They're much wiser than I am. So I got up to speak and I just tore into the crowd. And it's not even a standing room only. There are people literally packed outside in the hallway. So the interest from non-Indigenous ecologists is huge in Indigenous knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so this room is just packed with hundreds of people, and I just tear into everybody in the room. So anyway, I end up, of course, being like brought up on code of conduct charges or whatever.
Oh my God.
Yeah. No one paid attention to the fact that I'm talking about, you know, my sister's being sexually assaulted and you're like, that didn't matter. They just didn't like the language I was using.
Yeah. You made us feel uncomfortable.
Therefore. Right. You made us feel uncomfortable, right? Like sisters and them being assaulted. Right.
So,
good old white sensibilities. Right. Mm. So, you know, it's, And I can literally sit here, Jessica, and for the next 24 hours and just give you one incident like that after another. And that that incident, by the way, is actually like is watered down. That's not even close to the worst things I've experienced in the academy. I mean, that's like a footnote to some of the worst things I've experienced. So I'm staying away from academic communities in general, just trying to finish off my PhD and then see if I can find a way to remain embedded in my communities or with Native communities in general, doing the work that I'm doing with the nonprofit. And then I can consult with universities where we bring students out to the field, because I also don't like anything about how Western universities do pretty much anything, including how they teach. You know, I always say, like, the classroom is where education goes to die. and it's just not me, right? I the way I grew up, I can't be in a classroom with damn PowerPoint and doing all of that.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather, much rather be doing what I'm doing with Heritage Lands Collective, which is bringing our youth out to work with their own communities and in the field and experience that wondrous experience of being with elders in these sacred sites. I mean, that's real education, right? And working with these Native scholars, by the way, who have become family to me, you know, it's been an incredible blessing, because now I'm working on like multi-million-dollar grants of like developing Buffalo curriculum for Native producers and, you know, working with several different tribal colleges to develop the curriculum for their students on Buffalo handling. And we're developing a Buffalo certificate for the University of Montana and Nueta Hidatsa College. And so there's a lot of wonderful things that have come out of that wonderful richness. And so I really don't need to be on a campus anywhere. I've developed the network. I've developed my own university, if you will, of Indigenous scholars and wonderful allies as well that work with us. And so there's a lot of work to be, you know, a lot of work for me to do. I really don't need a traditional academic position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So we're at our second break point, but when we come back, I'd like to talk more about how you recommend people respectfully engage with tribes and talk more about Heritage Lands Collective and what you'd like to be doing with that and your vision for the future. Okay. So we left off the last segment talking about, you were starting to talk about how to respectfully engage with tribes and Indigenous people. So can you talk more about what you recommend to people when, you know, it sounds like you get a lot of emails of people saying, you know, how do I work with tribes? What would you tell those people?
Yeah, I think maybe at least based on now rather extensive experience with people wanting to work with tribes and seeing their approach, I think it might be helpful for me to outline kind of how one typically goes about doing it, mm-hmm. and then to talk about what parts of that not to do.
Because
there have been trends, right? I'm a scientist, so I tend to notice trends about human behavior and other. So one of the trends is, well, I'll send people an email, right? I'll find out somebody that I could potentially work with and send them an email. And typically the email is this, when people send me, like I have many white colleagues who'll send me emails and say, hey, like, is this appropriate to send to so-and-so, the tribal person that I want to work with? And typically what the email looks like is a giant dissertation of like, here's who I am. Here's like all the wonderful work I've done. And here's some more about me and how special I am and things like, and it's like, that's cool. And that works in Western contexts. It's not the way you introduce yourself to a Native person, right? I mean, if you really want to turn somebody off, You know, that's the perfect way to do it, is to send them your resume and tell them how amazing you are and, like, you know, all how much you like want to save Native communities and things like that. Like, don't, bad approach, right? You know, the first thing I tell people is, if you want to work with Native communities, you have to become a certain type of person first. Mm-hmm. And that's where things lag down, because they think of it as like a process. There's a 12-step process of, you know, what's the protocol? You know, where do I step and what do I do? And that's not how it works. You have to become a certain type of person first, right? Kind of like, in order for you to have a healthy relationship with any other human being, you have to become a certain type of person first, right? It's not there isn't like, oh, what's the, where's the manual to having a good, healthy relationship with somebody? There is no such thing. You have to work on yourself quite a bit, both outside of a relationship and within the relationship, right? So what kind of person should you be, or what sort of characteristics do you need to develop first? Well, number one, I've already mentioned, if you grew up in Western contexts in a typical suburban home and with kind of Western culture, you know, really self-assess whether you've adopted any form of arrogance or narcissism or self-importance, because that will come off really clearly when you interact with Indigenous people. And it's one of the biggest turnoffs right away. So that kind of deep sort of self-investigation, if you will, of how was I raised? Was I raised to like serve others? Was I, you know, did my parents ever take me to like serve in a food shelter, in a soup kitchen or a shelter of some kind? Did my parents emphasize, did my guardians, whoever raised me, emphasize like thinking about others in any way? Or was it all about me and my needs and, you know, the toys I need and the privileges I get to have and things like that? Because if that's the way you were raised, that's not your fault. But there are certain characteristics that develop about a person, if they're raised that way, that will not fit well at all with Native communities. And if anything, you'll end up just causing harm rather than good. And so a whole lot of kind of self-probing, if you will, to understand where you come from, what your position is. Positionality is very important. And then a whole lot of like understanding of the community or communities that you want to work with. And so take a lot of time reading and investigation and learning as much as possible, as much as possible about the community itself, from the perspective of the community. So if you can find books, articles, you know,
websites,
panels, anything that tells you about a particular community from their perspective, that, I really emphasize that, from their perspective, that would be a great way to start in terms of at least building basic knowledge. And that's all you're doing when you're doing that. So it's important to understand you're not going in as an expert about them. You're building very basic knowledge, right? It's like me reading somebody's dating profile or something, right? Like very right, like I'm learning very basic things about you, maybe, but I'm only going to learn that you like cats versus dogs or something like that, right? I'm not going to learn anything deeper about you until I engage with you in a relational, reciprocal manner, right? So you know, you can start off that way. You can, you know, start off by self-assessment, and then, you know, gain some book knowledge, some background knowledge about the community, and then after you do that, you can then honestly say to yourself, do my priorities and the community's understanding of the world, does my worldview and the community's worldview, do those actually go together at all, right? Is there a point of connection here, right? Mm-hmm. Find the way that you can connect to the community, just like you would with somebody you're interested in romantically or friendship wise or anything, right? You find a way to connect with the community where it's important for them and where you have the skill sets to be able to connect there. So as an ecologist, right, you might be concerned about ecological restoration or certain plant communities or animal communities, right? And those might be important to that tribe. And you can start by connecting there. And then find out who to call. Usually it's, you know, the Department of Natural Resources folks, you know, whoever, the Historic Preservation Office folks, you know, depending on your particular focus of research and skill sets as a scholar. And then you would contact those people by calling them. I wouldn't really email, you know, try to find their numbers and call them and then begin a conversation by saying, hey, I'm so-and-so from such-and-such university. I work at the university that was once the tribal homelands of the whatever people, the Apache people. Right. I work at this university that has benefited from your lands and from which I benefit now. Right. Mm-hmm. Which brings different meaning to land acknowledgments. Right. We're not doing them, you know, for pretentious reasons to feel like good liberal white people. We're now saying like, hey, I realize like I'm getting paid because your people were genocided from this area and the university was taken mm-hmm. by force from these lands. And so now what I'm doing, I realize, is giving back. I want to give back as a gift and an appreciation for the benefits I've gotten to enjoy by being a faculty member or student or whatever at this university. And so find out wherever you happen to be in the country, find out what tribes were there historically and try to connect with those tribes first and foremost. Try to give back to those tribes that you've benefited from. And can again, through a phone call, you would introduce yourself very briefly, and then you would say, you know, the skill sets, the things I have to offer to serve the tribe are the following. I'm a vegetation ecologist. I'm a whatever, right? Let them know what your skills happen to be and say, you know, I would love it if I can somehow connect with you guys on something that's a high priority for you, based on your current needs and priorities. And could you tell me a little bit more about, you know, what are some projects or things of interest to you and the community now? And we can maybe talk about areas where I can serve. And so approaching it with a servant's heart, right? Approaching it with the heart of somebody who wants a genuine, deeper relationship with somebody they care about. Mm-hmm. If you don't, again, in order for you to do that properly, you have to be a certain type of person, right? Because your brain is always going to default to whatever it is you have historically done, right? So if you approach people in an exploitative manner, like, oh, she's hot, I want to have her, whatever, or he's hot, right? if that's the way you approach humans and have gotten, you know, if that's the habit you've built over the course of your life, Please don't do anything with tribes. Stay away, because mm-hmm. you're going to approach them in an exploitative manner. That's where your brain is going to default. Mm-hmm. And so you know, develop the important habits of real relationship building first before you try to work with tribes or any vulnerable, underrepresented, minoritarized community for that matter. So you would say, you know, hey, what do you care about? You person, you tribe that I care about. What do you want? What do you care about? The typical way people approach at this point is they've already applied for a proposal, right? Because the academia has no consciousness at all with how things work in terms of connecting with tribes. And so they encourage their academics to go and apply, you know, you apply for funding, you propose the research you're interested in, and then you go to a tribe and see if you can work with them. No. How do you know they give two bits of a rat's ass about your research? Like, mm-hmm. you don't know that that's important to them at all. That's like I know that you like chocolate covered almonds, Jessica. Mm. But
you've outed me. Right.
but then I go and buy, you know, whatever I think you should like and then give it to you and say, hey, you should enjoy this because I think it's what you should like. And it's like, no, dude, that's not how you that's no, right? No.
I don't want those calories.
Right. So you have every right to like throw that back in my face and say, hey, you know, I like chocolate covered almonds. Like, I told you, right? Like, right. So it's basic relational knowledge, but which has been part of the shock to my system of like how abjectly ignorant people are of just basic relational knowledge. Like, how do you approach somebody you care about? Do you know what it means to care about somebody? Like, do we have to go back to basics on that? Because clearly so, right? Clearly so. So approach with humility, build habits of humility, approach with humility, and then approach with skill sets that are important to genuine relationality. And when you do that, it'll come off. It'll come off clearly. You'll begin your research through relationship with the tribe. What's important to you? Now that I know what's important to you, now we can go look for funding that fits what's important to you. Let's apply to the funding together. Let's make sure that the funding pays you and your youth. And right, so what I want to do is make sure that any benefits that I get as an academic when I apply for funding goes to the tribe, right? Not just to me. It's okay. I need to pay my bills too. So it's okay for me to get paid through grants, but it needs to also benefit the tribe as much as possible. So if I'm going to hire, you know, interns, I'm going to hire tribal youth from that community. If I'm going to hire research associates, it's going to be from that community as much as possible, right? Mm-hmm. Building capacity within the community, making sure that the benefits go directly to the community. So the proposal has been developed with them under their guidance. The research is developed with them under their guidance. The outcomes are developed with them under their guidance, and the outputs go to benefit them under their guidance. So as long as that's the approach, everything else is kind of minor cultural things that you'll learn over time, right? Mm-hmm. Other things are really minor. So learning how to conduct research with tribes in terms of them leading, it has to be community led, and it has to be an iterative process, meaning that the entire time that you're conducting this research from conception, before you even conceive of what your questions are going to be, to the end, the entire time it has to be under tribal guidance, and it has to be iterative, meaning that you're always going to the tribe and saying, hey, am I still doing this correctly? Is this still within your interest? Is this within your purview? Or do we need to change anything, et cetera, right?
Right.
Now, when you consider it that way, here's the thing, Jessica, when you consider it that way, it's almost virtually impossible for a Western academic to conduct proper research with a tribe, because all the timelines on the funding end, on the university end, all the timelines have no contact, no consciousness at all with what it means to work with tribal communities, right?
Yeah.
I mean, today you submitted a request for an extension for one of the grant projects we're working on. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for that. We need to give proper time for our tribal partner to review the report that we're sending them. We need to, you know, have review sessions with our federal agency partners, et cetera, right? There's a huge, right? And that report may not be a priority for the tribe anytime soon. So what happens with the funding agency if we go back to them and say, hey, it's now December 2024, and we still haven't heard from the tribe. Sorry, we have to wait, right? That funding agency is far less likely to come back and say, yeah, we're going to fund your future projects, dude. It's like you're lagging. You know, we have timelines we have to meet, and they're not in accord with tribal priorities. And so it makes it incredibly difficult to be in a settler colonial institution and continue to work with tribes in any meaningful manner, because you have to meet a certain timeline that has no conscious connection whatsoever with tribal timelines.
Absolutely. Yeah. I want to add a couple like specific things that people who are hearing what you're saying might not have heard of, or I mean, thought of. Well, and first of all, just to touch on what you were saying right there, know that it's going to take a lot longer than you think, and plan for that, and ask for more time in the beginning. Much more time than you think you're going to need. And also the parts that are under your control, try and do those parts as quickly as you can, or like time it to leave as much time as possible for the tribe, like their aspects of the grant, to try and make sure that there's going to be adequate time. But touching on a couple of the like things that you were talking about there, you mentioned it being an iterative process and going back. So I think a lot of times people, like, they make that first phone call. And I mean, obviously we're guilty of this too in the work that we do in cultural resource management, because like you said, a lot of times it's like we get the grant and then we have to approach the tribes, which is really not the way that it's supposed to be done. But, you know, that first conversation that you have where they're like, oh yeah, we're on board, these are our goals, blah, 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 that's not enough, like you were saying, to go pursue funding or things like that necessarily. If you haven't worked with that community before, ideally you're going to want to go in person and meet people, bring food, you know, do all of those things and expect, for example, that your proposal might need to go through council. So it might not be up to that office on whether or not you're allowed to do the kind of work that you need to do. And so again, if you're pursuing a grant, like you want to make sure things are ready, like on your end, after the tribe's told you what they want, as soon as possible, so that they have enough time if they need to go through those processes of like getting on the council's docket or whatever.
Right.
Which again, like, and then, you know, they put out these call for proposals that are like 2 weeks and you're like, I don't know what that is. But just some like specific thoughts on moments where I see people tripping up, myself included.
Yeah, for sure. Cause I think people don't understand that you're not, at least here in the United States, you're not working with a community. You're working with a sovereign nation. Mm-hmm. So that's a very important distinction to make, because no one can just, it's not, you don't just contact, say, the director of the Department of Natural Resources at whatever tribe and they just make the decision. No, they have to take it to council and, you know, Congress essentially, and Congress needs to decide on whether this is worth their time and effort, whether they trust you or not, right? Whether they want to dedicate any time or resources to this. That's kind of the next step. Like when people understand the those first few steps that I mentioned of like the basics,
right?
That's kind of the next step where I take people where I'm like, okay, now let's get into the nitty gritty of the actual step-by-step process of how to do this properly. Right. And what to expect. Yeah. What to expect on the tribal end, because that's the other thing that's missing. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, man, we've talked for quite a while. So real quick, I want to hear about your vision for Heritage Lands Collective and the work that you want to be doing.
Yeah. So thanks to the foundational work you and Dr. Kathleen Van Vlack have done, you know, we can take Heritage Lands Collective now into a kind of a new era in terms of its purview. And so, you know, for Native communities, cultural heritage and ecological heritage are one and the same thing. There is no difference between plant and animal relatives, rocks, waters, sky, etc. And these are all sacred beings of existence, right? And they're all interconnected. And so there's no differentiation. Like I always get criticized as being in settler colonial institutions. I've always been criticized, even when I was an undergraduate, of like you're not focused enough. You need to be like laser focused on one subject matter, right? And it's people don't understand anything about how Indigenous people do science. And so the reason I can do anthropological work and ecological work is because in my mind they're the same dang thing. They're the same exact thing, right? There is no separation between how people live and how our plant and animal relatives thrive, survive, and interact with us. We're all one. We're all one big relationship. So, you know, for Heritage Lands Collective, we're not going to differentiate between those two things anymore. We're starting, for example, a project in Hove and Weep, where this is a wonderful project because our federal partners are literally applied for funding based on tribal desire. And so based on conversations with tribal members, you know, we're going to go and restore via tribal knowledge, we're going to go and do some ecological restoration of the Hove and Weep springs that are important to the communities. And because the park wants to restore those springs, you know, this is, again, one of those points of connection where the tribe wants them restored and want their plant and animal relatives restored there. And the National Park Service wants the same thing. And so we're doing ecological restoration, we're doing applied ethnographic heritage work, and all of those things are combined. And what we're going to be focusing on moving forward is not just having where we bring the people to these heritage sites for visits on occasion, but where we're moving towards, you know, bring them to the sites and then, extracting knowledge from them. Yeah, knowledge that'll go back to the tribe first and foremost, but will also inform the federal agencies on how to manage these lands. That's wonderful in itself, but what we want to do is reach a deeper relationality between all of us, between tribes and federal agencies in terms of land management. And so we're going to be moving towards co-management as much as possible in every avenue that we can, where via our Indigenous internships, you know, what I'm hoping to do is connect tribal students with these federal agencies and then have some kind of a relationship develop there where they're able to apply for federal jobs. And so there's an immediate connection between communities and these federal agencies via their own youth, where now tribal priorities become, over time, hopefully become the priorities of our federal partners. And co-management can then begin in that manner via relationships, via these deeper relationships. Yeah, and many more things coming down the pike. Not just co-management, but also I'm trying to raise funding for something that you did, Jessica, youth elder camps. And these experiences would be incredibly rare and wonderful for both the elders and the youth, going out to these heritage sites together and youth learning directly from their elders in place, in situ. You know, that's a dream. It's a dream come true, and hopefully we can make it work. And I'm working like a madman to try and raise funding to support that for hopefully for 2025. That's kind of the vision, is that we move from, you know, sort of tribal consultation for us to manage the land for you kind of attitude to you are co-equal partners. And more importantly, you're not stakeholders, you're rights holders. This is your land. Mm-hmm. This is your land. And so being rights holders as sovereign nations, your perspective isn't just something that, you know, we're being nice people by respecting your perspective. No. Your perspective, we have to respect by every right of human dignity, of law, etc. And so now the tribe becomes a co-equal partner in management of these sacred sites and ecologies. And hopefully it's run by future generations of Indigenous youth going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anyone out there listening wants to help support these types of efforts that Joseph just mentioned, you can always go to heritagelands.org/donate. Or if you just go to heritagelands.org, there's a big old donate button. So I definitely encourage everyone, if they're interested, to support our internship programs, to support these youth elder camps that Joseph is working on finding funding for, and just, you know, all of these other efforts like the Hovenweep one that he mentioned, which I agree, I'm super excited about and is a really special opportunity that I'm glad we get to be part of. So on that note, I just want to say thank you again, Joseph, so much for coming back and spending more time with us. I certainly could have asked you a lot more questions. I know that there's a lot more that we could have talked about. So maybe sometime we'll have to have you back on the podcast. But yeah, thank you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been wonderful. Always good conversation with you, Jessica. And if I've left any questions unanswered for people, I'm fairly easy to find online. You connect with me on Twitter or X, I guess, and Facebook or whatever it's called now, and Facebook and through the university and things like that. But yeah, feel free to reach out, and happy to have a conversation with anyone who's willing and wants to work with tribes. I highly encourage people to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or through Heritage Lands Collective.
That's right.
Yeah, and as always, I wish that the off-air conversations had been aired, because it was hilarious. I haven't laughed that hard in a while, but and I'll leave everybody wondering what that was. But thank you, and we'll talk to you later. Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.